and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. Turkey and the European Union reached a framework agreement on the refugee crisis, but does it violate European and international law? The Turkish government continues its assault on the media, newspapers seized, and journalists sent to jail. Could an American citizen be the Prime Minister of Ukraine by the end of the week? Speculation about the resignation of Prime Minister Yatsenyuk is in the air, with a former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine saying that U.S.-born Finance Minister Natalie Yuresko could soon be appointed Prime Minister. Is this just old-style colonialism with slightly new branding? Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu snubs President Obama once again, but Vice President Joe Biden has arrived now in Israel to increase U.S. military funding by $40 billion for Israel over the next decade. What's next in the U.S.-Israeli relationship? But first, we turn to Turkey's agreement with the European Union on refugees that comes as the Erdogan government has waged an assault on opposition media. We are joined from Istanbul by Kemal Ukoyan, a regular columnist for the Seoul newspaper and a leader of the Communist Party Turkey.
Hello.
What is the plan that was proposed by the European Union at the summit with Turkey on Monday? What are Turkey's motivations for accepting this plan?
I think the bargaining is still continuing. There is no real fixed agreement till now. But we hear the news that there is some development in the negotiations. So there's a concrete plan from each side. I think they are going to make an agreement in the end. First of all, I have to say that this is a real dirty bargaining. Turkish government has great responsibility in the tragic war in Syria. The refugees crisis, I think, is an outcome of the terrorist acts of NATO, Turkey, and other reactionary forces in the region. In addition to that, as Turkey opened the borders to different terrorist groups, so as there was a traffic of those armed groups, the residents living close to the Turkish border had to leave Syria to escape from massacres and other killings. So this was on purpose by the Turkish government. And then we know that Turkey encouraged people to go by boat or through the sea to the Greek islands. This is a terrible issue. We know that the authorities encouraged this, engaged with this human traffic. And now they are using this to blackmail European Union. Well, Turkey wants money, 3 billion euros and more, and a visa exception. And of course, Turkish Prime Minister demands once again a joint land force and a free zone in Syria. Well, as I said, we still don't know whether there will be an agreement soon or not. But I have to also add that European Union is not so innocent in this game also. Okay, Turkey is doing a very dirty bargaining. But you see, European Union is also one of the actors in the Syrian, especially Germany, France, those countries, Britain. They have their hands in Syria. So they are also responsible for this big human tragedy.
It's really amazing, isn't it? You have the Turkish government pursuing a policy of civil war to carry out regime change in Syria, funding and providing arms to terrorist organizations, and then those terrorist organizations creating mayhem and havoc, force people to leave. And then the Turkish government, what you're saying, I believe, is using those same refugees as sort of human capital, as a bargaining chip with the EU for different purposes. money, ascension perhaps to the EU, and also a ground force in Syria. And you have, as you said, the European governments, which also promoted the idea that Assad must go and funded and helped the civil war in Syria. Now they are in crisis and coming back. I mean, it's an amazing human tragedy where you have these complicit players. Right now, let me just ask you, though, about Turkey, because you are there. You are a leading journalist for the Seoul newspaper. Turkey applied to join the European Economic Community, the predecessor of the EU in 1987. What has been the state of those negotiations, and could Turkey finally become an EU member as a consequence of these kind of negotiations? And more importantly, would it benefit the people of Turkey if the country did become a member of the EU?
Well, I will start with the last part of your question. Of course, Turkey will not benefit from the membership of European Union, and as a politician and a writer, I am fully against this process. Well, and I don't think that it will, in the end, Turkey will not be a member of European Union for several reasons that I have to explain here. Well, first of all, in the first years of those negotiations, the European Union stimulated the neoliberal policies in Turkish economy. And as an outcome, now Turkish economy is now very fragile, and some sectors, important industrial sectors, have nearly finished. And the worst thing is the Turkish agriculture is now very weak. You see, the European countries were criticizing Turkey as being an agricultural country, and they put quotas, so they destroyed some of the products. And now Turkey is importing some agricultural products from Germany. This is ridiculous. So first of all, in the first years of those negotiations, Turkish economy was destroyed. Well, now the membership process for both sides mean bargaining, political bargaining. You see, Turkey is a strategically important country, and as there's a big problem between Russia and United States and all other NATO countries, Turkey is a Black Sea country, Turkey is a neighborhood country, a neighbor country with Russia, and is an important actor in the Middle East. European Union cannot get rid of Turkey. They have no power for that. So there is, and in that sense, there's an interdependency for both sides. But we have to say that Turkish economy is highly dependent to German economy. The German companies, big monopolies, have big shares in Turkish industry, especially on metal sector. So we think that this process will go on till the end without the membership. And I think all know that Turkey will never become a member.
Let me ask you about something else that's happening in Turkey right now. The Turkish government took over the opposition newspaper Zaman and a news agency a day or two later. What does that mean, and why the takeover of Zaman in particular? What's going on? Because that newspaper was led by individuals who in the past were very, very close to the Turkish president.
Well, I think you got the real point. Well, Zaman was led by the Gulen movement, which is one of the most reactionary fundamentalist groups, a big group, which has a lot of economic strength. So at the beginning of the Erdogan government, starting from 2002, Gulen movement supported in every means Erdogan, especially during the attempts against some officers in the Turkish army. So they were highly organized within the state body, in the police, in the juridical system, in the army. So, but, you know, what happened was since 3 or 4 years, there's a big clash within the government or the governmental bloc, let us say. So it has some economic reasons, political reasons, and we know that Gülen movement is highly controlled by United States. So we have to understand that there are some problems between United States government leadership with Erdogan, although they supported Erdogan for such a long time. So Erdogan did make a counter move against Gülen movement, and it is not only Zaman. They have closed or banned nearly all of the publications of Gülen movement, and some other also newspapers. So now nearly the three quarters of the newspapers printed, daily newspapers printed in Turkey, is in the hands of Erdogan. But to tell the truth, nobody reads now daily newspapers. Turkey's main media is now internet, social media, and some other sources. So TV stations and the printed daily newspapers are under the control of the government, but nobody has interest on those publications.
You're the editor of a left-wing newspaper in Turkey. What kind of repression or challenges do newspapers such as yours face in the current political climate in Turkey, if any? I know Turkey, this is according to the Reporters Without Borders World Press Freedom Index in 2015. I don't know if you consider it reliable, but they say Turkey ranks 149th among the 180 countries in the index, meaning pretty bad for journalists in Turkey.
Well, there are a lot of journalists in prison in Turkey, and the government insists that these are in prison not because of their journalism, but it is not true. Well, our daily news portal in internet, it is one of the most influential media sources in Turkey. Near several hundred thousand people daily visit. It's one of the most visited sources. Well, every day nearly, there is a new court for some of our articles. This is also a blackmailing, because you are not put, you are not arrested directly. But if you, they say that if you have another juridical problem, and then you will be put into prison. So this is a real blackmailing. First of all, this is an aggression towards journalists. Plus, it is a financial aggression, because they sometimes you are not put into prison, but they say that you have to pay a lot of money. And alternative news sources do not have money with like big media. So, of course, I'm not saying that it is directly linked or it is about us or Seoul. It is against all the opposition sources. So all the journalists, all the writers, intellectuals, and politicians are under threat in Erdogan's Turkey. And this is normal, but we are continuing our struggle, and the life continues.
We have about 3.5 minutes left. I want to go back to the agreement. As you said, maybe not all the T's are crossed and I's dotted. Maybe the ink is still wet, or it's not even fully printed yet. But the reports that we're hearing is that all new irregular migrants, so-called refugees, coming from Turkey to the Greek islands will be returned to Turkey, with the EU meeting the costs. And irregular migrants means all those outside normal transit procedures, that is, without documentation. And in exchange for every person, every returned Syrian, one Syrian refugee from Turkey will be resettled in the EU. In other words, this seems to defy all of European law and international law when you're dealing with subsets of people fleeing from war-torn areas, seeking asylum status, and treating everyone as a quid pro quo. Talk about the human suffering for the refugees in Turkey. There's more than 2 million now. More than 2,000 arrive in Greece every day.
Yes, that's true. Well, the agreement that you have said, the specific part, it is related with also the cheap labor force that Germany and other European countries are looking for. You see, what they say is they are going to send back all the refugees that come from Turkey and then come here and choose the refugees that they want to have in European Union. This is the procedure now in Turkey also for the Turkish industrialists. They go to the camps and choose more educated or more proper, let us say, refugees, people coming from Syria, because you have to take into account that most of them are really educated labor force. So you have to realize that there is this economic aspect also, because European Union is now very old society. They need a new labor force. So that they are looking at the Syrians also as a new source of educated, cheap labor force. This is also a very dirty thing. They have no interest with the human tragedy. They are all only thinking their own interests. In Turkey, the refugees, they are in terrible conditions. You see, all the authorities, the small capitalists, or let us say businessmen, they are trying to get the money that they have. Even, you see, for example, when you see some photos, people die when they are crossing to the Greek islands. These are not only accidents. They are killed on purpose for their money, because those people sold their animals, sold their houses, land, and come here with, in average, 10 or 15,000 euros.
Yeah.
So people, in order to take those money, they even sabotage the boats.
I think we're out of time. So you're talking that the refugees, too, are victimized by piracy and gangs and deliberate murder. We want to have you back, Kamel Okuyan. We want to talk about this more. This obviously is a very major story for Europe, for Turkey, and of course for the people of the Middle East. After a short break, we will be right back.
Loud and clear. Loud and clear.
We are back. I'm Brian Becker. Could a U.S. citizen, yes, an American, be the prime minister of Ukraine by the end of the week? Speculation about the resignation of Prime Minister Yatsenyuk is in the air, with the former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine saying that U.S.-born finance minister Natalie Jaresko could soon be appointed to the post. We are joined by Daniel McAdams, the executive director of the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity. Welcome back, Daniel.
Hi, Brian. It's good to be back.
What's happening in Ukraine? Who is Natalie Jaresko? And could she be the country's next prime minister? And even more importantly, here you have momentous developments taking place in Ukraine. Ukraine was all over the Western media in February and January 2014. Now it's not being discussed at all. It's like, what about Ukraine? We don't care. Talk about it.
Well, you know, we've already fixed Ukraine and we're going on to fix Syria. So, you know, we don't, we fixed Libya a few years ago. So, nobody in the U.S. likes to go back and look at these things. The attention span is very short. These revolutions, no one has much interest after they're over. So the fact that things are heating up in Ukraine again, the fact that there's more violence, it's just too much for the Americans to bear. They're too busy looking at what Mr. Trump has to say or what Hillary Clinton has to say in the race. So unfortunately, that's the problem. It's like a child who goes through his room and breaks his toys, you know, and is not interested in after they're broken. This is the U.S. foreign policy of intervention, unfortunately.
Yeah, and other people pay a very, very heavy price. Is Ukraine a failed state at this point? I mean, it wasn't a failed state. It had many, many problems. But go over what's happened after Maidan protest and starting with what I consider to be a coup d'etat supported by Western powers. Talk about what's actually happened to the country.
Well, it's funny if you think back that what the U.S. was saying about Ukraine and the reason why Yanukovych had to be overthrown was this terrible corruption. We're going to get rid of this terribly corrupt government and bring in a clean new government that will be the model of reform. Well, look at how Ukraine has sunk. The economy is non-existent. Regular infusions of U.S. money are the only thing that keeps the country alive. It is politically absolutely incapable of getting anything done. You know, there are fights that regularly break out in parliament. It's really kind of a laughing stock of a nation. And corruption is, if not as bad, worse than it was under Yanukovych. And the U.S., again, says absolutely nothing. It's just ironically, the U.S. Is mouthing the old, the sort of empty slogans of the old past Soviet era, even, you know, I don't know, you probably read Patrick Smith, who I think is brilliant, and he writes at Salon. I was reading a long article that he did a couple of days ago, and he was talking about how now the Ukrainians think they're going to be a major world leader in the production of military equipment, you know, and anyone who knows the situation of industry in Ukraine right now can't help themselves but laugh. It's just an absolute joke. It's a complete disaster, but they'll use the words structural reforms. Ukraine must carry out structural reforms. This is what U.S. Ambassador Jeffrey Pyatt is saying. He said they need to take meaningful steps to reform the trade and investment climate. What does that mean? It doesn't mean anything. It's just empty words.
Well, as you said, the United States government made the point that Yanukovych was either a puppet of Vladimir Putin in Russia, or he was an oligarch, or he was corrupt. And that's why the protest movement in Maidan should be supported, was supported, supported by Victoria Nuland, who said even was heard on a phone call saying Yatsenyuk, the current prime minister, who may be replaced with an American in a few days, was the preferred choice of the United States. We had all of that. And now, as you said, the corruption, if anything, is worse. The country is divided. Lots of people, thousands of people have died in the civil war, especially in the eastern part of the country. I mean, outside of what you said, the lack of attention span on the part of the Americans or distraction by whatever's in the news. I mean, talk about the geostrategic significance of what's happened, because the United States government obviously wasn't only motivated or ever motivated by corruption, because they're not saying that the current government should be overthrown as they did with Yanukovych. And the current government, Poroshenko, says the top priority for Ukraine, a country now hobbled where so many people live in poverty, the top priority is for that country to become a member of NATO, a U.S.-led military alliance. Talk about the geopolitics of it.
Well, I think that's critically important. And, you know, we've seen, you know, over the past few months, so many indications of what the U.S. is really interested in Central and Eastern Europe. It was Ashton Carter, the U.S. Defense Secretary, who said that the U.S. is going to quadruple its military spending in Europe. It's going to send in a lot more troops. It's going to send troops and bases into countries where it's never been before, and it's going to ramp up its activities on Russia's border. It's all about encircling Russia, and then if Russia makes any sounds, Russia is militarizing, you know. And this, I'm just reading a piece recently. The Pentagon is planning to put thousands more troops in Europe as well, ramping up spending. So it has a lot more to do with the U.S. strategic position in the area than getting rid of a corrupt, supposedly corrupt government and putting in one that is more in tune with Western liking. But, you know, the idea that Ukraine is going to be a normal European country is laughable because nobody in the rest of Europe will buy any Ukrainian products. Certainly Western Europe is not interested in buying, and I think we talked about this last time, in agricultural products from Ukraine. They've got to keep their own farmers from going ballistic, and they have to protect their own agriculture. There really is nothing to Ukraine. There's no way out of this mess. I don't see a way out of the mess for Ukraine. I don't know, maybe someone smarter than me does, but I don't see what it does to move ahead.
Ukraine is a big country. It was, in addition to Russia, the second most important country in a way within the old Soviet Union, within the old Soviet structure. We have the dissolution of the Soviet Union following the 1991 collapse of the USSR. In Georgia, Mikhail Saakashvili was the president of Georgia and a favored political person by the United States who began a war against Russia, or Russia at least intervened militarily, and Saakashvili lost there. Kind of that situation froze militarily. Now he is the governor of Odessa, in Ukraine, and you have Saakashvili, Georgian, as the governor of a Ukrainian state, a region, Odessa, and you now have an American possibly becoming the prime minister. I mean, it seems like a coup d'etat followed by another coup d'etat. What do you think?
It's interesting. You know, one little interesting tidbit about Saakashvili, he actually learned Ukrainian as a border guard for the Soviet Union back before the collapse of the Soviet Union. But it's certainly a fitting thing to have Saakashvili involved in Ukraine, because he was another beneficiary of the U.S. color revolution / regime change foreign policy. He was placed into power after the people supposedly went to the streets to demand a new government taking over for the old corrupt regime and the old corrupt and repressive regime. Well, as soon as Saakashvili was placed in power, his government was far more corrupt than his predecessor. He was far more repressive. His views on freedom of the media and freedom of speech were something out of the dark ages. Yet he remained the U.S. favorite, even though, like in Ukraine, he certainly did not democratize or add more freedom to the country. So it's perfect to have him there. As to Yaresko, it's funny. I wrote something about her about a year ago when she, I guess, was just getting in as finance minister. One of the first things that she did, and this might be something that we can look forward to if she rises to prime minister, she sent a letter to John McCain saying, "We need you to send us more weapons. Send us, lawyers, guns, and money." So makes you wonder now, with things heating up in the east part of the country, and Yaresko, who is, by the way, an incredibly, I would say, corrupt representative of the kind of worst sort of Americans that are sent into these countries. You know, she was hooked up into a USAID enterprise fund that was capitalized with $150 million. And these things are supposed to go and show the locals how wonderful capitalism and democracy is. But really what it does is it shows them how rich you can get if you're a crony fake capitalist. She ran this money into the ground. I think out of $150 million, there was about 100,000 left. She paid a separate company that she had millions of dollars in special fees. Just a complete, absolute corrupt disaster. And the reward, however, for being a loyal lackey of Washington is the position she has now, and maybe something even higher.
I mean, she was an investment banker who served, as you said, as the Ukraine's Minister of Finance. But she just became a Ukrainian citizen in December 2014, the day of her appointment as Minister of Finance. I mean, it looks like old-style colonialism. I mean, it feels like old-style colonialism, where the United States government goes in, both parties, Democrats and Republicans, and the State Department as the spearhead, carry out a coup d'etat using, at least in part, Nazi or neo-Nazi forces on the ground in Kiev. They picked the prime minister, Yatsenyuk. Yatsenyuk has an approval rating now of like 3%, I think. And Yaresko, who's an American who becomes a Ukrainian citizen only in December 14 now may become the prime minister. It does. It just looks like old style colonialism, but in Eastern Europe.
It is sort of a poetic ending to, you know, we used to try to have a bit of a fig leaf for the U.S. Deciding who would make up the governments of places that it overthrew. And now we've sort of tossed that aside to where we actually send American citizens as proconsuls over to these places to run them. It's like a cheap knockoff of the Roman Empire, you know, with some failed two-bit investment banker coming to take over. But it's funny you mentioned the crony capitalism, because it's not only Oresco, I know we're picking on her today, but let's go a little higher up. Look at Joe Biden's son, who very, very early on got himself a very, very attractive job over in Ukraine. And of course, there was no conflict of interest. It was just a coincidence. He's wonderfully talented and brilliant. And that's how he got this great job over in Ukraine. Right. You know, who believes that?
The Pentagon Quadrennial Report that was issued a year ago says Russia is the number one threat to the United States. It doesn't even, well, it mentions ISIS and Islamic terrorists, but in a sort of small way. It talks about China with more diplomatic language. It doesn't say they're the major threat, but it's about Russia. And we do see now a real escalation of NATO, a war game, so-called, not funny, not really games, military exercises right on Russia's border, and this projected huge multi-billion dollar military buildup, all on the basis that Russia is on the march, where, as we can see, if anything, even neutral governments like Yanukovych were overthrown by pro-U.S. coup d'etats right on Russia's border. Talk about the interconnectivity between the military industrial complex and the incentives that it has for a new Cold War with Russia, and what the impact is on the people in those countries.
No, I think you really nailed it, Brian, because this is what it is all about. I mean, there's simply no rationality in Washington anymore. You have the rule of the neocons and the think tankers. They make the policy. They're financed by the military industrial complex. You know, go to a place like the Institute for the Study of War, run by Kimberly Kagan. Take a look at her donors. It's out there in the open. It's Raytheon. It's all of the bomb makers. They openly fund these think tanks who then call for more war. And it keeps the neocons in enormously well-paid positions in Washington. And the idea that Russia is a threat is just simply good for their bottom line. They have to have something good for their bottom line. Now we have to go back into Libya because Hillary's great idea that we were going to turn it into a wonderful democracy didn't work, although she did say it's too early to tell whether it's a success or not. But now she's supporting sending in special forces to start a fighting in Libya. And of course, all of the people in Washington love it. The Beltway think tanks love it. It gives them more wars to plan. It allows them to stay in their positions, and it gives billions of dollars more to the military-industrial complex. It's a kind of a sick system that goes round and round. It benefits a very, very few people. But unfortunately, because of the way the media is so compliant and so close to government, the rest of America thinks that somehow this is keeping them safer. Whereas, in fact, what it is doing, it is making them much more vulnerable. It's destroying their economy. It's creating enemies overseas. And really, it's bringing the end of the American economy right up to our doorstep. So these people are I would say, anti-American. They are they are the real threat. Forget Russia. The neocons are the real number one threat to the United States.
Yeah, the neocons, and then there's another section of the Washington foreign policy establishment who seem like neocons, but they don't identify with the neocons. Matter of fact, they would say they're against the neocons. But take like Hillary Clinton, sort of that old mainstream liberal imperial foreign policy establishment, which at this point seems to have an undifferentiated position from the neocons. So thus, you can say that they're neocons. But here we have all of this passion, all of these mobilizations for this candidate or that candidate in the Republican and Democratic primary. But at the end of the day, if it's Hillary Clinton or Ted Cruz in particular, perhaps Trump is a little bit more of a maverick, even though his internal politics are so awful. But at the end of the day, the establishment has its candidate, and those political foreign policies seem to be almost identical.
They do. And sadly, as much as attractive as he might be on the surface, even someone like Bernie Sanders is not very satisfying if for an anti-war person when you look too deeply under the surface. But, you know, you're right about the left, and you've probably read this book, Brian, but there's a wonderful book written by Jean Bricmont and Dinah Johnstone called Humanitarian Imperialism. And the whole book is essentially how this faux left, whatever you want to call it, how they use the idea of human rights to sell war, just as the right uses the idea of national defense to sell war. And it really talks about them being two sides of the same coin. And I think it's a, you know, I highly recommend the book to any of your listeners. But there certainly is that, and war is very profitable. It makes careers. You know, it's the joke in Washington. I spent a lot of time there doing foreign policy on Capitol Hill. And nobody likes you to – if you're involved in an area and your recommendation is to do less, that's not good for your career. You know, if you're a foreign policy expert, you want more foreign policy. You want us to do more stuff. And unfortunately, there are no breaks involved. The Fed continues to print money to benefit the 1%, and that 1% includes a lot of the military-industrial complex. So the breaks are completely off. And the country's going insane, I think.
Well, hopefully the people of the country have sanity and will do something about it. We have been joined by Daniel McAdams. He's the executive director of the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity. After a short break, we will be right back.
Loud and clear. Loud and clear.
We are back. I'm Brian Becker. Joe Biden, vice president, is in Israel after Netanyahu cancels a visit with President Obama scheduled later in March. We're joined by Gada Talhami. She is a professor in Illinois. Welcome back, Gada.
Thank you.
So talk about this visit. I mean, here you have these very strained relations between Benjamin Netanyahu and President Obama and the Obama administration. Even though Israel gets $4 billion per year from the United States, Israel and the Israeli government acts like they're being constantly the aggrieved party in the relationship with the United States. And when Biden gets to Israel to, quote, patch things up with the Israeli government, because there's violence and some Israeli settlers or other Israeli citizens were stabbed, one died, that became the dominant news again in the corporate-owned media that the Palestinians are carrying out violent terrorist attacks. I mean, try to put this in perspective for our audience.
Okay, well, first of all, it's an election year. So I think the Democratic Party, represented by Biden and Obama, for the sake of their own party, cannot afford to be really very much in a strained relationship with Israel. It's an election year. Israeli-American relations always figure largely in election years. I'm even surprised this year that Sanders doesn't want to talk about it. But most of the time, all the candidates do actually talk about it. Now, there is something like an intifada going on. There are young people attacking Israelis by knives, sometimes actually not attacking anybody, and they get accused of brandishing a knife and get shot to death, shot to kill, just like the abuse of the police of Afro-American citizens in this country. Nobody wants to take a chance on somebody who looks unusual or looks like he might be carrying a weapon. Now, obviously those young people, not all of them are carrying knives because we have an unusual sort of ratio of people who are Palestinians who are killed in this confrontation for Israelis. I mean, there are few Israeli soldiers who actually, or civilians, settlers, who actually get killed. Most of the people who get killed are Palestinian kids. So we have, you know, to remember this equation. By the way, this really goes to the heart of the matter, and you mentioned the mainstream media, which is for many, many years, I think, the American public has been fed the line that the Palestinians are the terrorists and the Israelis are legitimate people with a legitimate government who have a right to defend themselves. Well, the Palestinians also have a right to defend themselves. And if the Israelis call themselves legitimate government, the Palestinians have rights under international law. And their rights under international law is that they should not be occupied, their land should not be taken from them, they should not be abused at the checkpoints on a daily basis. So you know, you would expect them to react. Now, unfortunately, I don't like this violence. I would much prefer to see civil disobedience, because I think civil disobedience wins you more friends. It's much more effective. And the whole world understands the strategy of Mandela and how that eventually worked. But when you're a young person living in a refugee camp, being invaded by the Israeli soldiers on a daily basis, or humiliated on a daily basis at the checkpoints, that really can go to your head. Adults and grown-ups can cope with this. Young people cannot. Exactly as we see in this country. I think the older generation of our Afro-American citizens can cope a little bit. But I think young Afro-American citizens cannot really cope emotionally or psychologically. And that's really what we're seeing in the West Bank right now.
Well, the West Bank was seized by the Israelis in June 1967, when they also seized parts of Egypt. They seized Gaza. They seized the Golan Heights. There have been numerous UN resolutions demanding that they leave. When President Obama took office in January 2009, he said the Israeli government should stop building settlements, meaning settlements in these illegally occupied territories seized after 1967. I'm not talking about historic Palestine that was seized in 1948-49. The last time Joe Biden went to Israel, well, not the last time, but the last time he went on an official visit, not including the Sharon funeral, was in 2010. And that was a diplomatic catastrophe in one way for the Obama administration, because as he arrived, the Netanyahu government announced they were building more settlements in East Jerusalem, meaning an obvious sort of slap against the Obama administration and the Israeli government, saying, you know what, we are going to do anything we want to do. Now, the United States gives Israel $4 billion a year. It's not the other way around. Why is it that the United States government cannot take effective measures to discipline an entity that receives such a big handout, the biggest recipient of U.S. foreign aid over every other country in the world?
Well, John Mearsheimer and Steve Walt wrote about this in their famous work on the Israeli lobby in this country. The work of the Israeli lobby has been unbelievable in the United States, to the extent that we Arabs in this country call United States Congress Israeli occupied territory. I mean, I heard from my own students who are interns with congressmen in Washington, they tell me this. They said when people from the Israeli lobby come in to Congress, I mean, you know, they are surrounded by people who just want their handouts. This is quite a machine. And it has been built over the years. And I think it has managed to restrain the chief executive in our government. And, you know, we know the frailty of the American system. The frailty of the American system is that there's quite a bit of deadlock exists always, actually always, between the executive branch and the legislative branch. This doesn't happen in Britain, where the prime minister, of course, is the head of the legislature as well as the head of the executive arm. It happens in the United States. Now, unfortunately for all of us, Mr. Obama came into office with great hope. Everybody had great hopes for him. He had extended an olive branch to the Muslim world as soon as he came into office. And people expected some kind of a different attitude towards at least the Israeli settlement. But he was doing exactly the same thing like his predecessors, and that is merely applying a slap on the wrist to Israel. And, you know, you mentioned building settlements in the Jerusalem area. That's an egregious act, because the Jerusalem occupation by Israel is not recognized by anybody in the world except, I think, El Salvador and Costa Rica. El Salvador and Costa Rica. So the entire world does not recognize Israel's occupation of at least East Jerusalem. They also don't recognize Israel's occupation of West Jerusalem. Yet this is really an egregious case where Israel wills to build settlements and will go up about doing it regardless. So what does the United States do? Nothing. It's all words. What does the EU do? The EU, of course, lives in the shadow of the United States, really doesn't take any action on its own. All the EU does is says, well, we won't buy your products from the settlements. as if that really matters to the Israelis. What has happened is we expected at the end of the Cold War that at least the idea of Israel as a strategic asset to the United States would have been put to the test. Well, it hasn't. They managed to survive the end of the Cold War by redefining themselves as a great asset in the war on terrorism. Whereas we all should recognize, I think my students in Politics 101 recognize, that what really led to all the disruption in the Middle East, to all the terrorism, to all the hatred of the United States, is this constant, you know, historic alignment between Israel and between the United States, ignoring the suffering of Palestinians, the suffering of the Druze community on the Golan Heights, the suffering of the Lebanese in southern Lebanon, and we can go on and on and on and on. So you see, this is very clever. If you read the writings of the neocons, the people who were advising George W. Bush in his war in Iraq, they were really very happy with the situation as it is, and now they define Israel as the greatest asset in the war on terrorism, whereas in reality, once the United States introduced its own troops in the Middle East, and we began to do this with the presidency of the first Bush administration, that means the use of Israeli troops has become redundant. We've never actually seen Israeli troops used in an American war in the Middle East.
Yes.
It doesn't work. It doesn't work because the United States, including Bush Sr., recognized immediately he needed Arab allies.
Let me ask you about this a little bit more, Gada. We have the Israeli lobby. Okay, they're very powerful, and it's well recognized that they have had a lot of power, but they're not an omnipresent and, you know, a power that cannot be overcome. You take the case of the Iran nuclear agreement, the Joint Comprehensive Plan. AIPAC, the Israeli lobby, certainly the Netanyahu government, in alliance with the Republicans, were dead set against that. And the United States, for its own strategic purposes, at least the policy pursued by President Obama, made sure that in spite of Israeli opposition and in spite of the power of the Israeli lobby, they signed that agreement. Now, in the case of the American Jewish community, a big part of that Jewish community, as you well know, has become more and more disillusioned with the very right-wing and racist policies of the Netanyahu government and of Israeli body politic in general. And they are to the left. They are voting for the Democratic Party generally, but they're not giving a blank check to Israel. And that's why I'm wondering whether or not this pondering problem, this question, the Israelis get $4 billion each year from the United States. Netanyahu is now negotiating with Biden and the Pentagon for $40 billion over the next 10 years, $40 billion in military armaments. And is that really just the Israeli lobby, or is there a geostrategic outlook where the United States sees Israel as an extension of American power in this resource-rich and geostrategically important part of the world?
Very good point. I think this is really, you hit it on the head. First of all, apropos the Iranian agreement, interestingly, the same week when United States signed its agreement with Iran and people here were complaining about how this weakens Israel, in the same week, nobody said anything about Israel receiving two nuclear subs from Germany in order to survive, they say, in case of an attack on their own atomic reactor at Dimona. So, you know, they're even planning for the future. So this is really unbelievable. They receive nuclear subs free. I don't think they even pay for it, from Germany with the approval of the U.S., definitely. And yet they complain about the threat posed by a nuclear Iran. And the media doesn't say a word about it. But you brought another point, which is absolutely accurate. Some of the criticisms of Mearsheimer's and Stephen Walt's book has been is that they have exaggerated the case of the Israeli lobby. In other words, United States is not such a weak country that it can be led by the nose by the Israeli lobby. Clearly, there are people in the American government, and here we have to be very clear, probably the CIA and the military, who still see their interests combined with the interests of Israel, and actually they're happy with the relationship the way it is. So it is not as simple as it sounds, or as Mearsheimer and Walt have actually painted it to be. There are these two points. There is the fact that our electoral system is really out of whack. that, you know, the Supreme Court says it's okay. You can make any donation to any candidate, right? So anybody can buy American candidates. That's really something we have to worry about. Supreme Court says it's okay. This is very unusual in a democracy, okay? The second thing is we have this famous organization called the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, APAC, which really has dominated the arena of Middle East politics to an extent. But you are right, it's beginning to show some cracks. There's something called J Street now, which is really an organization that still supports Israel on many issues, but would like to see it change some of its policies. And there is, of course, the disillusionment of many of the younger Jewish Americans who simply cannot reconcile what they believe in and the behavior of Israel as the only country in the world that actually occupies a huge civilian population and abuses their human rights on a daily basis. So, but has this been effective? Not yet. This is still a grassroots movement. We're building. You see now the BDS movement, the boycott and divestment movement. You see Jewish Voices for Peace. You see J Street. So there are voices from the bottom up who are actually questioning the former solid American Jewish alliance behind Israel. When will it become effective? I'm not so sure. There is one hope. The only hope is Mr. Obama would have the courage, as a lame duck president, whichever way we define a lame duck presidency, to take some action before he leaves office. What is that, the shape of that action? He could withhold American economic aid from Israel, which Israel spends on the settlements, okay? James Baker, Secretary of State for the first Bush administration, has actually threatened to do that against the government of Yitzhak Shamir. He said, we will withhold the amount of money you spend on the settlements from your annual gift that you get from the United States. Of course, the Israelis listened. They're very careful, actually, about what goes on in the United States. We haven't done that yet, seriously. All we have done is a slap on the wrist. If Mr. Obama could have the courage, oh, he's already, by the way, had demonstrated some courage. He refused to let Pollard, the former American Jewish spy, to go to Israel after his release. He said you have to abide by the rules of the American court system. He has to actually stay in New York. And the Israelis were dying to bring him to Israel and make a big hero out of him. But that's symbolic. I mean, Pollard now isn't really that effective. Okay? But will Mr. Obama have the courage in his last few months of office to do something about the settlements, to stop his opposition to the state of Palestine being recognized by all agencies in the UN? I don't know. If he can do that, I think he really will go down in history as the one single American president, even greater than Jimmy Carter, who has done something in the direction of solving the Arab-Israeli issue.
Yes, we'll see. I mean, that would be really, really something if President Obama would do that. It appears that the Israeli government, Netanyahu, snubbed Obama by not telling the White House directly, but letting the Israeli media announce that he's actually not coming to Washington, D.C. towards the end of the month at the same time that the APAC meeting is taking place. And yet President Obama dispatched Joe Biden. There is a sea change happening in public opinion. Even on March 20th, when the APAC meets, there will be a very large demonstration at the White House called Stand with Palestine. I know people are coming on buses from all over the country. There is a lot happening at the grassroots. In the last 30 seconds, Gada, tell people if they're interested in being part of the BDS movement, boycott, divest, sanction, what could they do? What could they do, say, at their campus? You're at a campus.
Yes, they could support Muslim and Palestinian students in organizing and stop making an issue out of the tactics of the BDS movement. I mean, the BDS movement is engaging in something no different than the anti-apartheid movement when South Africa wasn't liberated yet. Why is it okay for us, for instance, to stand with South Africa and we can't stand with the Palestinians?
That's the question, because we know that the anti-apartheid movement internationally made such a profound difference. That's all the time we have for today. We would like to thank Gada Talhami and our other guests. We will be back tomorrow. tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.